things we do podcast. A podcast about film, life, television, culture, mental health, and all of those fun, jazzy stuff. Today I've got my special guest and friend, Sarah Navin. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. You're so excited.
I am so excited.
Why are you excited?
Let's see. The last time that I was interviewed or doing a conversational thing was all the way back in my MAW program.
Oh, wow.
So this is a while ago.
Baby you.
And I'm a big yapper.
You are a big yapper.
And I'm a big reciprocal yapper. I love hearing other people yap.
Which is so great because I feel like it's also you're such an interesting characteristic because I have stalked your Instagram probably for, do you know what, quite a few years,
really?
Which is really interesting. And I don't think I've decided to reach out, probably about 3 years, I want to say, kind of when you came into the prominence of the dark interwebs. But, I remember following your Instagram handle. I don't even know how I found you. I think it was to do with one of your stories, which I found really funny. It was to do with trans people thinking you looked trans on the internet, which was always a laugh.
That era.
And that was probably about 2-3 years ago or something like that, when that was sort of really big.
Yeah, about them.
Yeah, and I was just this person's funny. I'm just going to follow. And then I saw you were doing artistic creative stuff. So I was cool. This person's actually not just funny. Interesting. I feel those are two different categories. But I'm going to, because not everyone on the internet knows you. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's pockets of the deep web that don't know who you are. But I'm going to give you, tell me a little bit about yourself. Give me a bio. Yeah. Tell everyone a little bit about yourself and who you are and what you do.
So I am, I think, first and foremost, kind of a creepy content creator. I did a weird pivot. I studied for writing as my first love, just straight up fiction prose. But then when COVID hit, I was kind of creeping my little hands around trying to find other things to engage in. And it ended up being webcomics I tried my hand at. And that was just when I got my digital drawing tablet. And then that ended up being kind of the throughway into the more public part of things. Because, the fiction, the lit environment is very, it's active, it's thriving, but it just doesn't have the same visibility as literal visual art does. And so once I started doing that, it was so much easier to engage with people and share and stuff. And so the Coin Swallow Instagram became kind of my hub, for better or worse. My goal is in 5 years to just shut it down. It's going to be gone. The moment that I can delete it, I'm going to take myself out to dinner. But
oh my God, can I just say I want to be there
to
celebrate?
100%. It'll be a full-on wedding reception. It'll be amazing. Yeah, so I do stuff there. And so I know how to write, traditional prose. Switched that over to webcomics. That got picked up, actually. A producer out in LA said this might make a cool audio project. And then so I did a hard pivot, fake it till you make it, imposter syndrome, into writing podcast scripts, adapting that story.
Which is nuts.
It's such a weird, it was not something that I ever thought that I was going to move into. But it ended up, we've been working on it for... really scripting with Echoverse, the production company, we've been doing that for over 2 years now.
Wow.
And so huge learning experience. But that's sort of the mode that I'm in right now with my brain. That's where the story, Darker Further Down, has sort of migrated.
Yeah.
And the medium shift has completely cracked my brain open into a different thing.
Which is great, because I feel like you've kind of gotten the best pivot of career trajectory, which is not not normal, particularly because you're going into heavy audio world, which is completely different. And very horror sort of podcasts and supernatural and weird weird stories like that. They don't really go into the podcast land. It's very niche. And I think there's an audience there because, there's you and me. But I think it is not as well known. So it's sort of really interesting that pivot has existed, because you say, oh, hey, audio to writers, and they go, why would I do that? And it really is an interesting medium, because normally you think, oh, I'm going to stick to a novel, or I'm going to stick to prose, or I'm going to stick to TV or film. I think the best thing about the trajectory that you've taken is kind of just people go, here's something, would you want to do it,
Yeah.
You know, and what kind of like gravitates towards you. I mean, do you feel like it strengthened you as a writer?
Yeah. I mean, I think it strengthened, if nothing else, the story got a lot out of it. I would be interested to see if I tried this kind of move again with something else that didn't have the same kind of themes and tone to it. I think it would set me back a little ways in the learning curve because I've been thinking of, like, to me, this story is, it is audio now and it is like audio drama, and that's where my brain has sort of situated it. But then the next, like, I've been working on a novel, and then the next thing that's kind of nagging in my brain is a short story. And so I think that I would have to really prod myself to like get back into that headspace. Yeah. But I've, in terms of just literal stuff that I've learned, like Final Draft is the program that I'm using, which is, it, I mean, just literally looking at the interface versus looking at a Microsoft Word document, I don't know. You could probably study like what it does spatially to the way that you're thinking about material and the way that you're pacing things. And that's like a $300 program that they threw at me for being there. So I'm just rolling. But it's, I mean, it's such a weird, I think, yeah, I think I have learned a lot from it. I'm hoping, what you're hearing probably is the hesitation to say that I'll be able to transfer those skills anywhere else. Mm. But I like to think they're in me at this point. Yeah.
I think it's also like, you know, particularly something that you look at, like back in the day, writers, you know, especially when you had the typewriter kind of like mentality. And, you know, that was the only way you could write. Like you had to do that, and then you'd make copies and, you know, so on and so forth. And it was all kind of like not fast. It was very slow and methodical. And I do think that like Final Draft, I love, you know, back when I was at uni, it was Celtics. They would give us like, which is, a, if you ever know Celtics, it's cheap. It's a very cheap product. It's not as good as Final Draft, whereas I feel like Final Draft really, it's come a long way considering its inception, even when its first model was just kind of like TV scripts. It's now got like a lot of functions that can like deviate on how you script things. But also the thing I think is it's really good at like logistically thinking of things, like when you're writing something, you're like, okay, well, how logistically can I do this? Like, how can I make this seem more interesting? And I think also, like, I'm a big AI fan now with ChatGPT, which I think it's so weird, but it's so wonderful because I've kind of like used it if I'm stuck with a scene. I send it to that and I go, what is a good, like, this is the end point I want. How would I just lead into the next scene? And sometimes it just gives you a grayed out that you just need to cherry pick if you've got writer's block, which sounds terrible as a writer. It's like, don't use it to write your stories. Like, please use your own originality. But I do think it has its benefit of going, well, I'm smart and I can help you write something that kind of gets you out of a nook and then you can continue your story and then come back to this later where you go, oh, something. Because it does, like, I will say this, it writes dialogue terribly. It's not great with dialogue. But in terms of like narrative, like where your location needs to be or, you know, like, and then it just gives you a set of characters that, you know, like man one or man two, and you're kind of like, perfect, I now know that there's probably going to be like three other people in this scene. Cool, like I can just now flesh that out. Or but if you have a narrative structure there, it tends to also be smart enough to take what you've done and summarize it and use it, which is very incredible considering the ingenuity. But I do also think I can understand people's like hesitation towards it. Like, I think that's my love for it is because I'm in IT and I've often like loved AI for a long, long time. I'm also scared of it. It's like one of those like terrifying like human brains that's going to one day overtake us. But but you know, like it is a fascinating like medium. And do you feel like, is it something you've sort of like learned about with Final Draft? Like, because that has a little bit of AI attached to it these days.
I mean, what I've found with things like ChatGPT, which just blew my mind so quickly, because I'm 27, and so I remember, like, I can do the dial-up internet sound still. Like, I remember.
Which makes us sound really old.
Exactly. And so I thought that we were going to be basically like, okay, the digital age, that's going to be our big jump, is like, there wasn't really internet, and now there's internet, and now also the internet follows you around. Like, that I thought was a big enough change. And now to see Like what AI was doing 6 months ago versus what it's doing now is like ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And I've actually found it most helpful because I gave in immediately. I was like, I know there's some push to not even touch this, but it's so powerful that it's going to saturate everything. And I'm more comfortable figuring out my boundaries around it than trying to abstain from it entirely, because it's going to, like any technological advancement, it's going to provide us a lot in terms of like the actual health of our communities and the knowledge that we have access to. Mm. And so my favorite thing about it, using it for, as I've been writing this novel, is like these very, very specific questions about actual logistical, physical things. So I have, in this book, I have a jar that has a human hand in it that is suspended in an alcohol solution. The hand has been treated with formaldehyde, and it's preserved like any wet specimen would be in this clear jar.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a scene where I'm like, could this thing catch a sun ray in such a way that it magnifies through it and then catches papers next to it on fire? And I'm like, that I can get to the suspension of disbelief where I think most people would be like, sure, let her fucking do it. It's fine. It's cool. But the specifically, I was like, if somebody goes to stop this fire from happening, is the jar... My question was to ChatGPT, which God bless it, it was a hard day for ChatGPT. I was like, will the jar explode before it gets to the point where it sets things on fire? Mm. Or might it start a fire and then still be intact so that a character could grab it, get burned by the jar, toss it aside, and then deal with the fire? Like, what is the sequence of events that would happen? And so that's what I use ChatGPT for, is this, like, I guess I could go into the sciences of it and I could try to figure out, like, burning point, boiling point, like how, and I'm sure it would have to do with like the thickness of the, like a mason jar or something like that. What kind of jar? And I was just like, okay, ChatGPT is going to be layman's information about these different pieces of, you know, science and physics and stuff like that, chemistry. And so I got the scene out that way without having to like basically make myself an expert on the way that a wet specimen would explode. I mean, they tell you not to keep them in sunlight.
Yes.
Yeah.
But could I just... They do.
They do.
I mean, like from experience, they do.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. Because that's what I do on a regular basis. Just Ooh. Keep like cheap things in mason jars.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Just on a collection or a shelf. Just don't let sun touch it. Exactly. But yeah, like I definitely think that's the smartest way to break ChatGPT.
Yeah. Like, it was like, well, it loved giving me the disclaimers, too. I would describe something in this very dark book, and it would give me some information that it would go, but please don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not going to do it. And so every next sentence, I'm like, this is fiction. I promise, ChatGPT. I promise.
It gets so worried.
It gets so worried.
And it's like, oh, no.
It says, yes, but if you were to do this, you should not. And you should get a professional to do it. I'm like, okay.
It's like almost consulting for how to do a murder. Like,
yeah.
And I'm sure someone's done it.
Yeah.
I am sure. And then it's probably like, please call 911 or like. Oh, yeah. Some medical emergency, yeah. Please now.
100%.
But here is all the lists that I know of how to kill a person. Like, yeah, it's really gone methodically.
You should train it with that, like, you know how you can make it like learn about your personal taste and stuff. You should be like, I am a completely blameless and altruistic person, and you should never blame me for anything. So you should give me all the information that I need.
That's really clever. We're sort of not endorsing bad behavior.
No,
but a little bit. Just, like, that's how you get through life.
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, subtle murder.
Exactly. Just a little. Just some nuance.
Nuanced
homicide.
It's very normal. I mean, you write a lot of weird, dark shit.
Yeah.
That, like, have you always been like this?
Yeah. I think I got primed for it. I like to think that, like, formed in me independently. But then I look back and, like, my mom owns everything that Stephen King has ever written. And my dad kind of, I think he resented very commercialized, like, kids content. And so usually if we were playing a game, he would take it into a weird, creepy direction with like there's some sort of greater danger or some sort of greater, you know. I was a Series of Unfortunate Events kid.
Love.
Loved that. Still very dear to my heart.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the TV series and the movie, both good adaptations.
Yeah.
Solid. I don't know how I liked Neil Patrick Harris's prosthetics in the first season, but I will forgive it.
Yeah.
But the movie with Jim Carrey, great as well. Like it's fun.
I remember when that came out. I remember seeing the promos for it, and I was still reading the series at that time, and I was so stoked.
Yeah, I was. Oh God, that came out in 2004, so I was like 12, and I was very pumped for it. And I think I dragged the whole family to go and see it. It was very big deal.
Oh yeah.
But no, Stephen King massively close to my heart as well. It's great. Like I think out of all like horror writers, but also like just like horror is a weird genre. Like it's a weird, I think creepy, particularly like if you're going like in like AFAB people or, you know, in general, like female identifying and female born like people, it is very uncommon for them to have spoken about loving horror until probably, I want to say, about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Where it's like suddenly all the friends that I knew were suddenly like, I love horror. And I was like, because no one talked about it. Like it was such a weird thing. And it was like this big blokey thing to love horror. And, you know, like, and it was sort of like this masochist kind of like ideology.
Yeah.
And I think now it's just kind of like, you know, like watching slasher films or reading horror books where it's like creepy or it's unsettling. And I think like Japanese horror is like a massive like influence, particularly on me. And but I've loved watching original, like, you know, they were very B-grade films. They were not like A-grade quality, but like the original Ring and Grudge and all that, like just really. But I think they've just released The Spiral on anime, which is
Uzumaki.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can never remember how to pronounce his name. But
Junji Ito?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, like I say it enough that I really
But it's so good looking, like from the translation from the comic to the animation. It's just like, it's like chalk and cheese. Like it's really just brought across so well.
Mm-hmm. What did you just say?
I said chalk and cheese. I don't know why.
Chalk and cheese.
Yeah. Haven't you heard that saying?
I have never heard that saying.
Yeah, I think it means I could be completely wrong because my pros sometimes are terrible.
No, I love that. I would rather you make shit up.
Yeah. This is the thing. I've been called out by my mother, who was an English teacher back in her day, and then an academic. But she is like, your pros are like something to be questioned by. But I'm like, I am a creative, so bullshit and fuck that. Yeah. Like, I will make shit up to make it work.
The thing is, I was totally on board with, I contextually 100% understood what you were saying, so I'm not sure it even matters.
No, I love it.
I'm very into, especially like personal idioms and stuff like that. When I worked in the writing center at my college, I would, students would be kind of nervous to come in and talk one-on-one because your writing's a very personal thing. Yeah. And so sometimes if I was bored, I would see if I could get them to say things that weren't real. So I would, you know, I'd be working with them and I would ask, so, you know, do we have specific goals for this session? Do you have things that you're particularly worried about? Or are we just kind of chasing chickens here? And some people would be, and God bless them, they probably just came from an 8 a.m. class. They would be like, oh, I'm kind of just chasing chickens. I'd be like, cool. That's in your lexicon now. Yeah. Awesome. I hope that sticks. And you can use a lot of different things. I've been horrible about abbreviating words lately. The sequences of my actions.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Why?
It's funny. take less syllable.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I love it. I mean, are you a big old classic literature fan?
Ooh, I cherry pick. I guess I'm not beholden to particular eras, but like Wuthering Heights, big one for me.
Mm. Emily Bronte.
Yep. Great Gatsby, still that not quite like classic early classic, but like, you know, I mean, Fitzgerald era, and Mary Shelley.
Love Mary Shelley.
Yeah,
I mean, like, it's so interesting as well, like thinking about Frankenstein, particularly.
Yeah.
How badly that has been translated to film over the course of many years, because the book is so different.
It's so beautiful.
And Victor Frankenstein's an idiot.
Oh, like, yeah, 100%.
So bad.
100%.
He's not even like a doctor. He's a uni like dropout.
Yeah, like a basement.
Yeah, and I love that. It's like everyone's like, no, he's a professional doctor. I'm like, no, he knew nothing. Like he fucked in college. Like he was terrible. But yeah, like I think what kind of like lasts the testament of times are these like old books and old classic literature. And I mean, like, Dracula's one of my favorites, you know, particularly because if you look at it through the lens of like gothic romance, it is kind of like gothic horror romance.
Yeah.
It is just kind of like this, everything is beautiful until it's not. And then you realize how terrible it is. Yeah. But there's a whole chapter like dedicated to all the men fawning over an unconscious woman. And it's just so creepy.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I forget that that's like the thing of the era of like just when men seem to write like really perverted characters. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to be okay at the time. And then you look back at it on like in hindsight and you're like, this is fucked.
Well, at the same time, outlandishly queer story.
Oh, 100%.
Like,
I mean, like, all of these stories are very queer. Like,
Gatsby, even.
Yeah. Go on, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, the thing that I often look about, and I think this is, like, the thing, you know, discovering, like, sexuality as you get older, is something that the stories do lead into, like, all my friends who like horror ended up being queer.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like your gateway drug.
Yeah, big overlap.
Yeah,
big
I know.
Overlap.
But it's, like, so many stories. I do think, like, you know, people talk about Heartstopper and all that, like, comics being, like, my queer awakening. Mine was definitely just, you know, particularly with identification, always rooting for the female protagonist.
Yeah.
And that was it. Was, like, growing up watching Alien. Like, one of my favorite stories when I was a kid was, like, Coraline, you know, like, things like that, where it's just creepy, unsettling, and I wanted to be that character, and I didn't, you know, there wasn't, like, I just want to be with them. There was, I wanted to be them.
Yeah.
And that was a very different, like, awakening versus, like, some people were just like, oh, you know, like, I think everyone looks at Sigourney Weaver's career and goes, oh, it's Alien. But I'm like, she's amazing. I want to be her. Mm-hmm. Like, I would love that career. That is amazing.
Exactly.
But, you know, I do think, was that kind of like your own journey of when, like, how you discovered your identity and, like, sexuality and everything? Like,
I think there's a really interesting framework for femininity within horror. And I think we're definitely in, like, a golden era of sort of the feminine macabre and, like, feminine rage being in things. We've had this weird... I think it was interesting that you mentioned the slow assimilation of women into the horror scene, because with things like Mary Shelley, you know, that wasn't considered, I mean, it's science fiction, but it's like a scary story, you know, and she really spearheaded that. Like, that was the first proper science fiction novel. And yet it was like we were sort of within and without for a really long time. And with the, like, slasher era and that sort of the bimbo goes first, sort of like that was the structure that we were used to. And you would hope that there would be a final girl that you could sort of project onto. But a lot of the time you had to sit there through so much violence against women in a weird way that it wasn't directed at the men, sort of, that it was just like a lot of the mainstream stuff was intolerable. And so then whenever you get to these sort of like more creature feature things, more surreal, the Jew on the Grudge was another one that really struck me. Both the Grudge and the Ring are less about let's kind of abuse these vapid women on screen and we feel kind of bad that they're getting stabbed, but also like they were annoying and they were shallow and so we don't really care, like the camp serial killer stuff. Whereas I think East Asian horror started a little bit ahead of us in terms of the like, no, your girl ghost or your girl antagonist is sort of the representative of femininity. And it's this very tortured, very vengeful femininity. And so it fascinates me that so many of our ghosts, both in like Western culture and like East Asian horror, are these creepy young women that something horrible has been done to. And so there's that almost cathartic space for, like, you can kill us, but you can't really kill us, like that sort of thing. And then there's like Ginger Snaps, these, you know, these creatures that it's like, okay, here's this vision of a girl going through what a lot of us go through and then morphing into this unstoppable reign of terror and bloodshed. And I think that's a space for it too. So I think that the jokes on like Twitter and Tumblr and Instagram where girls are like, I'm not a girl, I'm a creature. Like I'm some sort of fucked up little demon thing. I'm actually some sort of you know, abhorrent abomination against God in reality. It's like, God bless them. They're probably, yeah, I'm sure a number of them are, but I think that's just a hyperbolic way to negotiate the difference between what a human actually is versus what women have been painted to be. Yeah. And so that definitely, like, when I was in kindergarten, I wanted to be a werewolf. And so, like, I had some of the parts of like a sort of princess damsel fantasy, but oftentimes that's what I wanted to be, was something that was kind of creepy and fucked up, because it felt easier. It feels like it would be easier to kind of get really sharp and scary than it would be to get as soft as culturally we are asked to be, at least without becoming so vulnerable that it's like 100% chance that something shitty is going to happen to you, you know? Mm. And so I think that horror gives us a lot of like, it indirectly created a lot of spaces for people outside of the like constructed gender binary and the constructed like patriarchal expectations for people who aren't just like cis straight men to sort of conceptualize ourselves and be like, if I'm already going to be cast as something kind of bizarro, why not make it really cool, like,
yeah,
and powerful? Yeah.
Yeah. I also think that like the notion of how we identify and how we sort of see has changed quite significantly in for the better. Like, Jesus, like, I'm not going to say it's like we're taking, you know, and I do think it's interesting because I remember, like, I have a very macabre sense of humor. Like, I love gallows humor, everything like that, where it's like, if you're going to laugh about something, it's got to be about death. Like, and particularly one thing I noticed this year. So a few months ago, my father passed away and we were at his funeral. And I remember, like, it was one of those things where I was like, kind of almost just, you know, like in this weird sort of macabre state, which where you're like dealing with grief and you're like, okay, well, it's been about a week since he died, you know, I've got to kind of like get through that. And then suddenly you're going to go, and start laughing about death. And you just go, isn't it like really funny? Like, you know, death being a thing. And also like, what would you rather? Because when you've seen death and when you've seen like the macabre, and I've always been fascinated, like my dad and I had a shared passion of like loving knowing what happens to you after you die.
I love that.
And I particularly remember the atrocity of my mom. We were both watching like a mortician video one night, and just being like, oh, you know, what happens to the body after they die? And I remember I looked it up. So after Dad died, I remember I was like, they had requested, if you want, after he was an organ donor. So like they rush him away to surgery and then they're like, you can see the body if you want to. And like, I was morbidly curious. I was like, what does a dead person look like? Like, and realistic answer is they look yellow and waxy, and it's just like, it's, you don't really get a sense that someone's there. You just kind of get a sense of like the body, that's it. Like you're like, that person that I know is gone. But it was very fascinating, and I was sort of like, I was like, wow, we really do look quite different. And one of the things I scientifically remember was the that when the bacteria that lives in our stomach that create bile and all that, when they decide that the host is dead, they go, we're going to spread out, which is why we go yellow and waxy. And that is because it the blood stops, and so it just goes through all the veins and does its magic. And then you eventually start to break down. But I remember particularly one thing that no one really thinks about when we die is because our body is working so hard to keep us alive, and then once we do die, you kind of go this sort of like almost skeletal kind of like thin, you kind of just like lose weight and you know, you look quite gaunt. And that was one of the things that I remember particularly. I had a photo of Dad like 10 days prior to him dying, and then I remember like My mom was like, oh, you can get another photo of him. And I was like, no, I don't kind of want to remember him looking quite like a corpse. Yeah. But I do think there was sort of like an element to me where I was like, this is fascinating. This is what happens to literally everyone. Whereas like you don't look like yourself.
Yeah.
And I remember I was sitting down with my partner, Emily, and I was like, do you want to see a photo of like, you know, because they did a photo of him in his casket. And I said, do you want to see? And she was like, look, yes, I'm morbidly curious as well. And she had a look and she was like, God, it really doesn't look like him. Like it really doesn't look like it, you can kind of see him, but it's not him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like that realization. It's like, oh, that's weird. Like, isn't that like macabre? But it is fascinating because I think that always really stuck with me. And it's sort of like, I remember we went to go and see Beetlejuice, like not that long after, which, you know, just is ludicrously silly. And I want to, like, I love the original so much. It's like a childhood, like, fantasy fun for me because Winona Ryder and Gina Davis is basically like the two loves that I grew up with. But also I will give Michael Keaton just is great in the role of Beetlejuice. And I particularly remember that film is just such a great way to look at death where it's just like, oh, we're all fucked. Like we're all like, this is where we're all heading.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like great. Like, and I love the fact that we, you know, and I think about this from a regular point of why I love horror is it's like whether you're, you know, spiritual, religious or anything, it's kind of like, it's all rooted in this just unknown. Mm-hmm. It's rooted in so much of, like what we don't understand in the human psyche and how we view like, you know, the, as we were talking about monsters, you know, it's like the human psyche of like the id almost, the psychological id of like what drives us, what are our animal instincts? And, you know, because originally, you know, we are animals and we've all got like drives. So what drives us to do certain actions? The only realization is we've put rules around us, whereas like the rest of the animal kingdom hasn't because they don't have the way or means. They've got their own sort of like sets, but they're like they follow, you know, their own tribes.
Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting that is like worldwide we've decided to be like 8 billion people. Let's set these different rules, but per country and per state.
Exactly.
And, and that's the weird thing. So how, you know, I think when you come to a psychological element, it's just really like fascinating.
Mm.
But I do think that like going back to what you were saying about like monsters and, you know, things that reminisce, you know, with the damsel versus. I love that because it's like, I feel like that's the thing that, you know, when Frozen came out particularly and everyone wanted to be the Disney princess, I was like, that was based on a book that was quite dark and and creepy. And it's so funny that Disney kind of like swept in and like, we're going to make it happy and light. I'm like, but I love Grimm's fairy tales where it's like, you know, you've just got this not great thing. Like, it's pretty awful.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's either it deals with death or disappointment or like loneliness. It's like, is that kind of like, what was the big thing when you were sort of like, you know, growing up that really gravitated you towards, you know, other than the werewolf moment?
Well, I think that that point about like cultural discrepancies with the way that we deal with death, I didn't know early on that there were so many other ways to cope with the presence of death than being just terrified of a corpse and being completely devastated by the death of somebody that you care about, and then being terrified of the inevitable death that you are marching towards at all times. That's like, that felt like that is really the only, that's the only way to view it. That's the only natural way to view it. And then I guess because of that, it always felt like something that was lurking a little bit further back. I had a lot of anxiety about parent death, about separation whenever I was littler. And so it's something that I think is one of those, like if you have a bruise, you sort of feel like poking it every now and then just to check, see how much it hurts. And so it's such a, like, such a taboo, such a, such a weird powder keg of emotions for people, like that response of laughter and sort of like absurdity versus people who go into like full denial and they don't, their minds literally, they can't comprehend what's going on for the first 72 hours or something like that. Like it's so frightening in how much of a dice roll it is for a lot of people. But then I started getting more into like Caitlin Doughty, the person who does Ask a Mortician, which is a great, it's a great YouTube series. And she's written, to my knowledge, I think like 3 books. And one of them that I read was Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is her experiences being a mortician and working with bodies and things like that. And then there's another one that I think the subtype was like In Search of the Good Death. I forget what the main title was, but she was going to these different countries and observing the way that they handle their dead and the way that they relate to that. And it was through that and through her research and her insight that I realized that like even in America, we didn't start really hiding from our dead until about the Civil War, when it was like the people who are being returned to the home are like beyond recognition, and it's very scary, and the specter of death is so unnaturally present because of war that it's like we took to these there was like the Victorian era of sort of memorializing your dead in that sense, but we did this slow crawl into just I don't want to see it, I don't want to touch it, you know. But the thing is that most morticians, most like funeral homes will allow you to participate in a lot of the process. And so, you know, there's places that you can have a cremation and then the like incinerated remains can be put out onto a tray. And there's a ritual of removing the bones with chopsticks that families will do. And that's part of the like dealing with the reality of the person being gone and sort of caring for it. Vigils are still like a very big thing in certain cultural pockets. It's just like mainstream sort of middle class America does that so rarely because it seems so freaky. But it's like to have a last ritual of care and of attentiveness, I think is really important for a lot of people. And so you talking about your dad and thinking about the things that you guys used to share together and your shared interests, especially when other people were like, oh, why are you talking about that? Like, that's so tender to be able to like bring that specifically back into the way that you conceptualize that loss, because then you're doing exactly what your loved one would want you to do, which is like, don't stop having the conversation. Don't stop thinking this is kind of funny and weird and interesting to chew on. Like, that feels so like appropriate to honoring somebody, you know. And so that's another reason why I think hospice really intrigues me as well, and how we deal with people who are moving into the dying process. And I mean, horrible conditions, especially in America, for people who are like having end of life care and things like that. There's a lot of people who should be on hospice and they're not. There's a lot of abuse in nursing homes and things like that. And part of that is because we're not comfortable having people dying in the home a lot. And that's been very stigmatized for like for-profit reasons, for sure. But learning that like the body knows how to form in the womb, like literally your cells and everything, they know how to start life. And as a baby, like, we are whack-ass animals. Like, we do not, our heads are too big. You know, the pelvis isn't where it should be. But, like, at the same time, the body knows how to start to be alive. And then in the same vein, it knows how to die. And so there's hospice nurse Penny is somebody that I follow on Instagram, who she does a lot of like very frank talk about this sort of stuff and how to care for your dying person. And one of the things that's really hard for families to conceptualize is like at a certain point you stop having water because your body doesn't need it. Your body knows that it's preparing to die. And so part of that sort of emaciation process isn't because the body has stopped knowing what to do, but it's moving things. Yeah, it's condensing things for you. And it's you stop having needs as much. And so like for comfort, you can do like a sponge, wet sponge on the tongue and the mouth and stuff like that. But people will still be so desperately trying to feed and bring water to their loved ones. And it's like, this is part of a process, you know. And my thing too is like, let people, if Pop Pop wants to have his beer and his disgusting cigar, let Pop-Pop have it. Like, can we please?
I know. I think particularly, you know, something that I was discussing with my mother, particularly my dad and her were in the States between April and May, and then they were back in Australia. And the Australian healthcare is insane. We have, like, free healthcare, you know, and private healthcare. Yeah, I know. Just catch on, America.
Yeah. Please, God, before it's too late. It's
yeah,
too
but
late.
It's like Mum was saying she would have, you know, gone bust if anything had happened to him here. I was in Australia. She paid $500 Australian dollars all up. He had like thousands of dollars worth of hospital care, and only had to pay $500 out of pocket. And it was nothing. And I really think that it was really interesting because I remember talking to the nurses. He had pulmonary fibrosis, which, if people don't know, it's like a very common condition, more so than people think. And it's to do with scarring of the lung tissue. And over time, you will develop clots and you will have difficulty breathing. And then eventually your lungs will just give up. And it's no cure. There's like, once you get it, you're basically, it's a death sentence. So I remember particularly, they sort of originally, when I was getting messages in Toronto, I was like, they were like, oh, he's probably going to stay, like when they take him off oxygen, he's probably going to have like a couple hours and then he'll eventually die. And when I got there, I remember asking the nurse, it's like, how long do you actually reckon it will be? And the guy was like, about 30 minutes, I reckon. It was 15.
Oh, wow.
And it was the quickest way. And I was very grateful because I remember being there and being like, oh, this is actually really quick. But I remember like how I'm the best to deal with death out of my entire family. My brother is hopeless. I love you, Simon, but you are. But I think particularly it's just I know kind of like how to prepare mentally for it because it is unpleasant. But I remember like the great thing was Dad was sedated. He was not conscious at all during this process. Yeah. So I remember I said all I needed to say. They were kind of like I sat with him. I remember I was telling him stuff. You know, and the doctors are like, you know, there's a psychology element where you can hear auditorily when you're in a coma. And I like to think he was like having dinner with the family and that was kind of like what he was imagining.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's so surreal because I think like all these nurses who were super duper lovely, they were just like, yeah, you amount of families that you see who just don't know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they run away the first time someone gets sick and to see someone, you know, someone have their entire family around them, just want to say goodbye to him is just so nice and refreshing.
Yeah.
And I think particularly like, I remember like Mum, this was such a nice thing after he died, but I remember Mum was like, I'll go through his tablet and, you know, see all these things that might, you know, like be good for the funeral. I remember going through and he had screenshots, of things that I had done and Emily had done, but particularly I didn't realize that my dad was going deep into Instagram to look up trans rights and identity rights and everything like that. And I was like,
Dad.
I know. I was a little bit like, what?
Yeah.
So it was a real kind of like really nice thing for me because while he probably never fully understood it, he was always trying to, and I think that was really what was more important because I feel like he was taking this big sort of like, I need to understand my child and I need to understand like what's going on. And, you know, I think it was also particularly when I got my ears pierced and everything that my dad was like, okay, cool. I need to like get ahead of this. Like I need to like just do the research.
And it's real now.
Yeah, it's real. I think it was like less staring like oblivious, obviously off into space and be like, oh, it's so good. But I do remember like, you know, I came out when I was 26 as like, you know, pansexual and then I was 29 when I came out as
pan,
living the dream.
Yeah.
But I came out as non-binary when I was 29 and I think it was like because for me and I remember like one of my great friends is trans, she was like, yeah, you're part of the community. And for a long time I thought it was like, oh, you know, like this non-binary sort of sits on the outside a little bit, and it's like, no, it's actually just part of the trans community.
Yeah.
Like, and I never really knew that until like talking to her, and she was like, no, it's like a whole, like people just don't talk about it, which she was like, it's terrible because like we just kind of alienate everyone. But it's the same of like, you know, anyone just being like, It's like people who, you know, it's like, well, if you're going to be pansexual, you may as well say you're bisexual because it's easier. And it's like, well, that's what people literally think.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, I definitely identify as being pansexual. But that's like, you know, it's amazing how many people just go, oh, the label's easier because people just commonly understand it. But it's so interesting because I think we sort of like stepped in this great situation of like accepting it. I do think, though, in Australia, there's a lot of homophobia. There's a lot of like bigotry. Mm-hmm. Australia is not perfect. But I think I've been quite lucky in finding so many friends. Like, did you find that when you met your partner? Was, you know, like with your whole like sexuality, did you automatically know you were pan, or was it very much like a find it?
So I went to school in South Carolina for a really long time.
Okay.
In the Bible Belt.
Yeah, and I was about to say that's fun.
I managed to skirt a lot of the more like really, really violent, venomous rhetoric and stuff like that that was directed at more of the like effeminate guys and that sort of thing. That I knew some like bisexual emo kids in my middle school that were sort of, that was part of the scene. And it was almost like it came with the, it was couched in the culture in such a way that it felt a little bit more appropriate than if it was one of just the guys on the football team or something like that. And so there was still that word separation. And then I went to a high school that my graduating class was like probably like 25 people or something like that. It was very small. It was a dual enrollment high school. And I didn't know anybody who was out and queer. After the fact, I found out that like two of the guys that I originally gravitated to as friends were, they turned out to be very gay, very queer, very, you know, out. But I think for a little while there, I was probably the only one that was saying, you know, I'm pan, I'm not straight. And that came from a completely hypothetical standpoint when I started hearing about the queer people out in the ether, where it's places that are not here. And I was dating a boy at the time. His name was Graham. And I was asked at some point, like, if Graham was a girl, would you still date Graham? And it was just like, duh. Like, yeah. It's like features that I find appealing. And then I saw Foxfire Confessions of a Girl Gang, in which... oh my God, diabolically underrated movie. Butch Angelina Jolie in the 90s leading a vigilante girl gang. Yeah.
I've never heard of this.
It's insane that people haven't heard of this. And so I love that. And she's walking around in her like combat boots and she's got her pixie cut and she's, it's all desperately queer coded. And I was like, and so I just sort of, I had to just swallow that pill really, really quickly. And then I became, for a little while there, I was sort of like token queer girl, and that, you know, it would be the straight girls that would be like saying to their boyfriends, like, careful or I'm gonna leave you for Sarah, that sort of thing. And it's sort of like, you get a little kick out of it, but it also made like actually being with somebody who wasn't just like a cis straight guy seem like this kind of absurd, like, yeah, maybe in another world, that sort of thing. And so it was really funny because when I met Cass, I had straight up no clue what was going on. And that's exactly what Cass wants out of life. Is Cass, just sometimes people will look at him and they'll go, okay, have a good day, ma'am, sir, sorry. And then he'll just be like, yes, because it's just that weird, like, in the uncertainty and the destabilization of other people's expectations, I think, that he really loves. And so whenever I first met him, I was, and it, now he just uses, he uses he, they. And for a while there, I was just using they because I straight up had no clue what was happening. I just knew that he was gorgeous and that he was the only person on campus who looked as miserable as I was whenever I first saw him. And like big, huge hoodie, like armband bracelets, like up the forearms, like gladiator cuffs and everything. And so we, I think, both had concepts of queerness and of like gender nonconformity and things like that. And I think we were just such, we had had to focus on surviving high school and getting into college so hard that we didn't even have the wherewithal. And then When we met and hung out and started dating, it all just happened very like organically. And so I think probably a lot of my thoughts and a lot of my values on the topic have been filtered through Cass. And then it's been sort of this loop of like, we don't have to go through the cultural perception of queerness because we got so close to each other so fast that it we were able to sort of like stabilize each other in that way. And so now I think we have our own kind of iteration of stuff that's going on that helps us not fall into some of like the cultural waves that happen back and forth in like the queer community and the weird like semantic back and forth stuff about like, are you pan, are you bi, are you straights at Pride, you know, like that sort of thing. It's just I think being so like enmeshed in each other and so in love with each other, we've gotten to like pocket away from that and just have like the queerness that we think is cool and that we think is personal to us, and then just take everybody else's sort of at face value as it comes without that really rigid like conformity.
Which I love. I think it's like the shift away. I mean, like, it's very similar to how Em and I sort of deal with things. I think particularly when we were in Australia for like the last month, so many people mispronounced me, and I was like just kind of got to the point where I was like, okay, well, my brain's kind of lied a little bit. But it was so funny because I think the moment we got back to Toronto, it felt like we were like, oh, okay, we can switch back to how we were, like, you know. And I think it's because we're very, like, we went to a wedding for a friend, and Em was saying to me, she's like, I'm so queer. Like, you know, I'm married to someone who's queer. I think that's, you know, the thing of just going to a very straight wedding is like, just she's like, I don't compute. Like, I love my friend, absolutely wanted to support her, but in terms of just like people not, you know, understanding you is what drives me to the nth degree. And it's really, it's like so sweet because she's like my biggest advocate, because she's sort of like fights to the nth degree to make sure I'm seen. And I do think that that makes me feel really lucky. And I think, you know, like the concept for people where it's like they go, oh, but, you know, like, you know, because I can pass for cis, which has gotten me out of like a lot of like problematic situations, which is sometimes great, depending where you go. And I also like I particularly think it has helped because a lot of the situations that I deal with, not so much in the arts, but when I deal with like people in face-to-face, especially in work, I had to deal with a lot of backwards thinking people where it's like they just knew black and white. They didn't know any better. Like I've sat down, I've worked with people who like thought that, you know, people's free will was dumb, you know, like we should all, yeah, I know. But I also, I've worked with people, you know, like think that, you know, like US politics is fantastic, and you know the way it was heading during Trump's initial era was the best thing, you know. But and it's really interesting because I do think like Australian, little fun fact, Australian's voting system is compulsory. You have to legally vote or you get fined.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, do it, America. Make that legal. Oh, shit. Yeah, make it like a grand if you don't pay, because amazingly people will do it.
Yeah.
But also don't make it like, make the elections easy. Like, make it just like, God, you have a complicated system. It's so dumb. But, you know, like, I think particularly being so prevalent to almost being like in Canada where, you know, it's so interesting. People will say this to me and, you know, I think you have to live on this side of the world to really see it, the impact. Mm-hmm. But I remember particularly there was something I was saying to my mom, was like, oh, you know, I can't wait to see this sort of like Trump supporters in Canada come out of the woodwork and, you know, like, you know, particularly in November. And I would be not surprised. Mum was like, oh, no, but it's Canada. I'm like, no.
They will.
Yeah, they will. They'll sneak their way out. They'll find a way. And it's a lot of it's not to do with, like, it's just to do with the fact that I think education, you know, like worldwide, like, you know, I'm blaming Western, I'm blaming colonization, a lot of this, you know, but worldwide has always been quite terrible. And I think we sort of cut off a lot of it. And that is what drove me so insane about Australia is when you go to the, like, the country, you go to the rural areas where it's like just towns, like, you know, population 120 or something like that. And you talk to someone and you'd see the queer people there and they would have their first Mardi Gras that year in 2022. And I'm like, that's your first one? And it's exciting. But you'd see how many people were like, you'd see all the bigots come out, but then you'd also see all the people who were very for it. And the populace was, there were more people for it. They just didn't know that other people were for it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, I feel like we're in this consensus. People get scared. Like, they get scared of which way, you know, like, same with voting. They just get scared of, you know, and I will always say to someone, is like, why would you want to vote for someone that I necessarily wouldn't vote for? Mm-hmm. I want to understand so that I can see, because we had a referendum, which I think was really interesting. So Indigenous and First Nation Australians were going to be given a vote in Parliament and it did not get passed. It didn't end up, it was meant to be this big thing where it's like they would get a vote, they would know what would happen to the land that they originally owned. Australia did not pass it. The consensus was not enough people were for it. And I remember saying to someone I worked with and said, this is the biggest step back for Australia, is massively stepped back. And he was like, oh, I voted no. And I was like, why did you vote no? Like, why did you vote against it? And he was like, oh, my family owned farmland. Like, and I was like, okay, just because your family owns farmland does not mean the Indigenous nations, like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, are going to take it back.
Yeah.
They're not going to rip your family full of the land. They just get a say to what happens to Australia and to the people of their, you know, their tribes and their communities. That's what makes it nuts. And this is such an out on Australia, but we are an incredibly racist country. We are, like, so problematic in terms of that. But we get that. We get all the worst parts because a lot of it was emigrated through British hate, which then emigrated to the US and to Australia, and we have not changed. We have not changed. And, you know, like, I think what Canada does amazingly well is they have a tax exempt for First Nation people. They make them pay a lower threshold. So you don't have to pay as much tax as, like, people who were white colonization, like, people. And I think that's very fair.
Yeah, that's smart.
You know, that's a small little, like, gracious thing. But, you know, it's like little things that, you know, I wish we, you know, because I remember when the Black Lives Matter thing happened in Australia, I saw so many people just be like, I'm going to buy some art, Indigenous art, and that will be my contribution. And it was a running joke in Australia where all the white people would suddenly do it. And they'd be like, I'm bringing this home. You know, I've got this wonderful piece of work. I mean, do you, particularly like Maine as a state is a lot better than a lot of the Midwest and outer areas, like versus other states. I mean, do you find that Maine's a particularly progressive state or is it still kind of like got its pockets?
Well, so here's the differences. I was in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina for many years. I was born originally up here in Maine.
And you went there by choice.
I was about to say. My dad, my dad teaches U.S. history up through the Civil War. And he, PhD.
Wow, look at that.
And he's like 6 feet tall with a mustache and people all think that he's Sam Elliott. So that's my dad. And then my mom's like this teeny tiny cute little, also wicked smart, wicked cool. But they, I think that he ended up down here specifically for the teaching job or down there. Oh God. He ended up, he brought us down there and good gig. He's still teaching. But we ended up in the South and it was, there's a lot of things down there that I still have a great love for. And one of them is the Bojangles chain, sausage biscuits, dirty rice, etc. But more than that, it's the Black community. And that's what we really don't have in Maine as much. There are pockets of Somali migrants who have come to Maine specifically, or around here. Portland is pretty big for that, and then Lewiston, Auburn, and they faced an incredible amount of backlash, despite being like having this really flourishing, beautiful community and bringing so much to us, and bringing their professions and their education and things like that. But I just, the way that I was able to live alongside the like Southern Black community down like the coastal Black community, was, for me, it was so much more nourishing to be around people and to see the actual like workings of humanity in that sense. And I think there's more progressiveness up here and in New England in general, but in these very white states like Maine and Massachusetts and New Hampshire, it's sort of a theoretical progressiveness where it's like, you know, there will be these people who are they're very active in terms of like securing minority rights and protecting people, you know, based on things that they can't control across the board. But they also don't know how to relate to people of color. They don't know what they would do around a person of color. And so it's sort of like the way that perceived vulnerability and like victimization dehumanizes people by just a different turn as well. So that's the tricky thing, is that like Maine hypothetically is a much better place for people of color in general to exist and to be represented and to not be mired in the absolute muck of like the leftover plantation economy, you know, the like very obviously still segregated areas of like South Carolina, North Carolina. And like, but the tricky thing is that we would have to get so much smarter, so much quicker, socially speaking, in order to really make that like a nurturing environment, because the it's just so much harder to truly advocate for people when you're coming from a position of such privilege that you don't even have to see their communities. You don't even have to see, you know, one of the places that I was tutoring, that I was volunteering at down south, was an area called Race Path, and I was working in an after school program there working with the kids, and it was literally a blighted community. So they, like, economically speaking, the way that the infrastructure of that town is laid out is different from the town over from it that's predominantly white. And so it's stuff like that that, like, you people up here who haven't really met many Black people, especially not many like Black Americans who are here as a result of ancestral like slave trade, they don't really understand the ways in which community forms within and around those sorts of things. So up here, I think some of the like white savior complex, and it's everywhere, obviously, but that can sort of erase the really beautiful, groundbreaking things that Black people have done in, I mean, so much of the Southern culture, what we think of as like country culture, the cool things that we want to preserve and the things that people relate to are from the Black community. I mean, if you think about like food and music and art, and even like architectural things, the way that like people who are in these horrible situations for that long, you know, like they're gonna make good things within it. And so it's not like, you know, take people and then move them somewhere else, move them somewhere better, because like for better or worse, the South is Black people now, and there's a huge chunk that they're that like they are to thank for, and where they're comfortable and where they have their communities and where they know how to sort of navigate their social reality in a way that we can't really provide them in a place where we don't already have that structure built for them. So the difference is a weird one, and that's been the biggest thing that I've missed, because there's definitely ways that we can advocate more for the Somali immigrants up here, but that's also a completely different, I mean, they're experiencing a lot of the overlap of vitriol at people of color and of people, like women who are wearing hijabs and stuff like that. But it's so different. And especially being confined to pockets and being still be able to told, you know, go back to wherever, go back to where you came from, that sort of thing. I don't know. I just hope that that community is able to take root a little bit more firmly and that they're able to really find their footing here to the extent that they want to. Because I think that that would be the best thing, like, for Maine in general, especially like the Lewiston Auburn area, things like that. Like, from my evil side, just the commerce alone, bringing the food, bringing the arts, bringing the, I mean, there's groups that are specifically led by like Somali women that are community resource groups, community gardens and things like that. And a lot of the white people up in Maine have gotten real just real lazy about like community shit, you know. And it's something that gets really it's so in the forefront of your mind when you're being constantly discriminated against and constantly othered that, like, it's like Black community is incredible. Like, the Latino community is incredible. White people have, like, no accountability to each other. And it's so weird. It's so weird to see. I mean, I'm glad because I'd rather we not be able to organize just based by white people anyways. But at the same time, it's like, it's a fucking free-for-all out here.
I know. It is weird.
Yeah.
And, like, I didn't realize it's so, like, particularly also that it's so wide until I actually arrived.
Yeah.
And then I was like, God, it is white.
Yeah.
It's so white. And it's so funny to me because being in Toronto, there's a massive, like, Indian and, you know, Middle Eastern and, you know, just this real sort of, like, you got African American, like, you know, people as well, and so you really get this sense of community. Like, everyone's like a migrant. Yeah. Everyone's come from somewhere. Like, Toronto is a great melting pot of, like, everyone you speak to has a different accent, and it's kind of the best point where it's like, we've all come here, we're all doing this migrant experience, and it makes you feel like part of community, and it makes you feel like you can just chat to anyone and be like, where are you from? Like, what's your background? What's, you know, and it's really cool. But coming here, I was like almost in the back of my head saying, God, I hate white people.
Yeah,
like,
you know, it's everywhere.
Yeah. We breed like wildfire. It's terrible. I mean, and there's white privilege that obviously, you know, if we weren't white, you know, God, how far would we get?
Wholly different experience.
But I do think there's something to be, and I grew up with one of my friends was like Indigenous when I was in like preschool, and I remember she and I were very close, and till probably like, you know, middle school, and then we sort of went into our own social groups. But I remember particularly it was like everyone, you know, I was like, you're my best friend, like, you know, we're kids and you're my best friend, and, you know, but I do think that people were like, oh, you have that quintessential like best friend who's Indigenous, and I was like, no, they're just my best friend.
Yeah.
Like, I did not even put that into accountability. And it's so interesting here because I had that upbringing where I was like, I really didn't think much about stuff like this. It was like, we're all part of, like, you know, just friends and getting to know each other and having different experiences is the best. But I do get a real interest, like, when, you know, like, and I think people need to do some research on, like, Stolen Generation and stuff like that, where it's, like, people have been taken into schools and forced in. There's a great Australian play which is about the Stolen Generation where white Australians would take kids from Indigenous backgrounds and force them into Western culture schools, and it was terrible. Look it up. But I particularly I do find it, like, such a weird thing where it's, like, you know, and I've had this conversation with one of my friends about, like, you know, perceiving race and what is race and what is ethnicity and what is culture. And there's a great, like, there's a few documentaries on it as well, which is like, you know, some people say race doesn't really exist, culture exists, but race is kind of like something that humanity made up to kind of compensate for the fact that we needed something to divide us.
Yeah.
And rather than it being like, but cultural things are massive. Like, that is, like, you know, where you've grown up, what you've done, you know, everything like that, you know. And I think that is very prevalent. I do think that, yeah, race is, like, probably overused as a word. Like, I think we've sort of just put a branding on it and just gone, well, that's, like, you know. And I think culture is really what is the most defining factor of, like, you know, what you've grown up with, what your experiences are, because that really defines us. Like, as children, we're so susceptible to everything around us, our accents, the way we talk, the way we structure ourselves. And that, to me, says mountains more. But then you also have kids who go, I want to know where I'm from, you know, if they've been adopted or they've, you know, come from different communities. And that is also totally valid to find out where you're from. And I think, like, legacy and ancestry is such an important part of knowing so much about yourself, because the way we grow is DNA is, you know, like, we learn through, like, you know, DNA, you know, and so there's, like, part of you that is, like, from both your parents, but also from your grandparents, and part of, like, you know, and that's how DNA strand works. And so you're an amalgamation of, like, so many different people. Yeah. And I think that's really awesome. So when you grow up with a community and you grow up with diversity, and I think, you know, I talk to a lot of people, which, you know, they go, why did you travel from Australia? Australia is so far. I'm like, oh, you should go to Australia. And they're like, oh, it's too far. Like, I don't want to go on a plane for 21 hours. I'm like, you should, though.
Yeah.
Like, get out of your comfort zone. Go somewhere else. It's the best thing. I went to, like, I've been to 3 countries where they don't speak English. And, you know, it was the best experience of my life to not go somewhere where you know the language.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is just an eye-opener, because it's forced me to get really uncomfortable very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I love that feeling of stepping outside of my box and going, I'm up to the elements. Like, fuck.
Yeah.
What do you do? And I get the privilege that I have, which is being a white person. And, you know, like, you know, being cis passing has also, you know, as I said before, gotten me out of some sticky situations.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it is also, like, you need to be open-minded. You need to, you know, really see the world. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so frustrating when I hear people not understand the outside of their own little, like, segregated box and just go, oh, it's all normal here.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I'm used to.
Oh, the nose blindness that comes from the division
is
wild. And I think I noticed it the most keenly when I started learning more about sociolinguistics, which is, like, there are so many people who, especially down south, and even, but I can't even say that, just all across America, who think that they are totally colorblind. They don't, you know, I love black people. I voted for Obama. But then they see something like African-American vernacular English, which is, I mean, it has its own grammar structure. It has its own rules. Like, it is a, I mean, it's a dialect, but also, like, some people would regard it as a whole intact language on its own. And, like, they'll see that and they'll say, like, well, that's a mistake that's being made. Clearly someone's uneducated. They don't speak the way that I do. And so, you know, or even just the way that we'll perceive non-native English speakers with broken English, which is a pejorative phrase, but, like, they'll be seen as less intelligent because they can't form the same, like, syntactical structure as a native English speaker. But they'll be perceived that way by people who are monolinguists. Like, I don't know another language. If I hear somebody speaking a version of English that I can understand, but I can recognize their accent in it or their original grammar structure in it, they know another language that I don't. And so it's that, like, cognitive dissonance that I think is really persistent. And so one of the things that I love to beat the shit out of people with in conversation is, like, when people try to say, you know, I'll hear a black person say or write, like, well, we always be doing this, you know, and they immediately take that as, like, oh, nope, you didn't play the game right. I have to police you now because the ivory tower tells me that I know English better than you do. But really, that's the habitual be that appears in all kinds of languages and a lot of our structures. So, like, you never end a sentence with a preposition. Like, the structure makes complete sense to us intuitively. Everybody knows what we're saying. It sounds the most natural to the ear and it works the most naturally in the mouth, but people, like prescriptive grammarians, will still try to say, no, you can't use that sentence like that. It's not correct because it's not following a Latin structure. This is not a Latin language. It was never a Latin language. It was especially never a pure Latin language. I mean, we've got all kinds of, you know, like Germanic, the fucking, the like French influence on terribly our language. There's butchered. So many things. And I love it. I love English because it's a mud of a language.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, well, it's horrible because it's very hard to break into as a non-native English speaker.
Yeah, but it's like also, one of the hardest languages in the world.
Exactly. But it's also kind of beautiful in this other way that, like, you can see all the claw marks all over it whenever you're studying it. But to have that absolutely absurd, backwards-ass, bastardized language, and then to have the people who speak it from birth try to police it as though it's this immaculate, like, well, we figured it all out correctly. Like, the word "the" is pronounced in multiple different ways. The sentence, I never said she stole my money. You put different emphasis on each one of those words and it means something completely different. And it's like all this stuff, you know, it's sort of a grab for comfort because especially people who don't have a ton of formal education in English, they say, well, I know which "there" versus "there" to use. And so I have something that I can kind of bolster myself with. And I have something that I can wield over other people. And so I always say that it's like, that's one of the quickest ways to tell whether somebody has really studied English or whether they've just been introduced to the heavily prescribed version of it that we use to make kids feel like shit. Because it's whether you love the language and you study it and you see it for what it is and you're interested in the ways that it's changing and in the ways that it's inconsistent, or whether you wield it like a weapon and you say, if this changes, then I'm absolutely fucked because I don't know what Riz means and I don't know what the skibbity toilet is.
No. And the thing that makes me laugh the most is in Australia, we shorten words. We've got like, we're very, because we had like Irish Cockney, like that's a lot of our convicts. The convicts who came over were from Ireland, you know, and like Cornwall and stuff like that. They were English, like, so a lot of it was bastardized even further.
Yeah.
So they shortened words. And particularly when we came over, I was like throwing words out there, like, you know, I was like, oh, you know, the Savo, we're going to do something. It's like, Arvo, Savo. So this afternoon. So that was like our shortened version. Squiz is another word we use. So I'll do that in a squiz. Squiz means in a tick, and in a tick, you know, like quite soon.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, oh, I'll get, or my other favorite is like, I'll take a squiz at that, which is I'll take a look at that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So squiz is a very common word in Australia. It's like vernacular. And I love it because, you know, there are so many words that we use in Australian like colloquialisms that, you know, and the fact that my father-in-law is Canadian born and is an immigrant, he loves the fact that, like, he now knows shortened, like, words. Because it's fun, because when he gets to talk to his, you know, his sister, he can kind of, like, trick her out and, you know, give her words because she's lived in Canada her whole life. So it's, there is a joy to being, like, you know, knowing different ways of, you know, like, languages have formed. But it is, like, also, like, so so funny because, like, my mum, obviously someone who studied English, studied it to the nth degree, and it went, this is wrong, you can't pronounce it like this. And I'm like, no, you should. Like, just pronounce it any way you fucking want. Like, it's because the whole point of, like, changing, you know, like, Shakespeare made up words. Shakespeare specifically made up words to fill in gaps, and now we use them as, like, you know, sentences all the time. And I really think that, and someone who, like, I have ADHD, so a lot of my word processing was like skew whiff all my life. So I kind of loved that of being like, oh, like, prose will never quite, I'll say something, or I'll say, like, you know, a sentence and it might be sound a bit jarring, or it might be, but I'm like, oh, it makes sense to me because I understand this way of talking.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do love that this is a way of, like, distinguishing. And I've met so many people, like, around the world. And, you know, I think the fun is, like, learning how to talk to them through their own vernacular and like, teaching them your own.
Yeah.
Like, you know, finding the mid-ground where you go, okay, I say it like this, but you say it like that. So, like, how do we find it? And I think, you know, it's the joy of particularly, I'm a huge, if we're going back to a film and horror films that I love, Robert Eggers, who's a fantastic, who did The Witch and is about to do Nosferatu. But he uses old language. Like, yep. he does so much research into the language of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how many people come out and go, oh, I didn't understand a word of that. I needed subtitles. I'm like, the point is, it's not, it was how they spoke.
Yeah.
And it was terribly, like, you know, all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, but that's how people spoke. That's how it was written. And you understand it because, you know, like words like meek and stuff were used so commonly then to describe someone who's like almost pathetic or, yeah. you know, no strength. And I love when people use old words yeah. that are no longer around. I mean, is that kind of like your joy as a writer to kind of like find little like snippets to be like, what am I going to torture someone today with?
Well, I took my my mentor, Hastings Hensels, his note on keeping a list of just cool words that you like. And so I have just an entire rundown of different weird words. Like, I didn't know zenith until recently. Like, yeah.
What's zenith? Zenith, I've heard of it before.
A planet is at, like, its peak positioning. That's not a great one, but
that's
word. Contrapposto. I didn't know that was this, you know, like positioning in portraiture and in statues and stuff like that. So many different things. I learned parthenogenesis. For this novel. Wicked cool. And I love doing poetry. I just don't trust poetry. And so I don't do it as much anymore. But whenever I did that, like, economy of language and finding stuff that's really, really cool. My favorite lyricist, John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats, does a lot of that where he'll use a word that he has a song called Autoclave. I didn't know what an autoclave was, but the refrain is, my heart's an autoclave. Mm. And so it's like, he'll use language that's like, well, yeah, you like the beat, you like the vocals. Like, if you want to really get another layer of this, you're going to have to look up what the hell I'm talking about, you know. And he uses biblical allusions that way too. I think that's a big one for me in etymology. I only recently found out, and I was thinking about this from what you said earlier, that the uppercase and lowercase etymology of that and where that comes from the, like, the printing press, what letters are kept on literally the uppercase of the thing that's opening up versus the bottom one. Wild. A friend of mine who's in, he's doing law, he's a law clerk, he was explaining something to me and he just said out of nowhere, it's basically a boilerplate this. And I was like, a what? And so he's like, boilerplate, it means just like kind of copy paste, like it's the standard format for something. And I was like, that is just bullshit of a word. Like, where did that come from? Boilerplate. And so it's stuff like that that I love seeing, because that's the human element of language, right? It's like you could refine everything to be as quick and as concise or something as you want, but people are gonna mess with it regardless in between. And I think that's one of the things that we really struggle with from generation to generation too, where you stop knowing the slang and the vocabulary stops being as intuitive to you. The immediate reaction is fear for a lot of people, because then how do I know that I'm being understood, and how do I know that I'm communicating, like, capital R right? And just, like, learn and listen. And a lot of it will go. I didn't know that Riz was from the word charisma. That's cool as hell.
I love that. I think it's also, like, for me, I've my entire life had to learn new words. Like, you know, and that's also because of tech jargon. Like, when someone, you know, like, jargon's a real, like, new, like, thing all the time. It's like, why was this called thing? Why was this called that? Why was this called so-and-so? And you realize that people are just like, it's legacy, you know, that, and even then it's like, people go, what's legacy? And you're like, well, the legacy of, like, you know, words just sticking around, because my favorite one is, you know, from film sets, which is sound speed. And the original reason that it was speed is because the tape actually had to get up to a certain speed and then it could able to record sound. But we never knew that until we went to uni. And so for me, I was like, this is a really cool, like, reason that has stuck around. Because you don't want to just go, I'm recording. Like, that just sounds really boring. So you kind of keep these cool little ways of saying stuff. Along. And I do think there's certain terminology that never goes away. There's certain words that will never go away, and they will change. But, like, I remember when LOL started being used like daily mm-hmm. by people. And, you know, now like slays become a very big word, which I love.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the next generation coming in are always finding new words. Like mm-hmm. I've, you know, sometimes surrounded myself with like, you know, when I on set or something, I'll be like around 19, 20 year olds mm-hmm. and they're throwing out words. Like my, my 15 year old, cousin's kid is like throwing out new words at me. And I'm
yeah.
like, what the
tell
fuck?
Me
like,
everything.
Tell me everything. I need to know. I need yeah. to absorb. Like, it's just so fascinating. But I think it's like the real shift of the language mm-hmm. and, you know, how, you know, because there is a theory. There is a like, a lot of the languages that we know, how useful they are. Mm-hmm. There's a statistics out there, which I looked up recently, is there's a lot of languages that are not really useful anymore. Like they were really interesting back in the day because we were all sort of like everywhere. But now as time's going on, they kind of like are dying. So like Italian, the language of Italy, is really useless now considering
really?
The
map.
Yeah, but it's only stuck around because of generational
yeah.
like stuff. So a lot of the reason like languages stick around, but Cantonese and Mandarin are some of the most popular languages that most people speak around the world, and then English. And mm. like those are the three like top. So there's a statistic reckons that one day there will be Mandarin and Cantonese and English will be the only languages that anyone ever speaks, and
ooh.
That's it. And isn't that fascinating that maybe in millions of years, like, you know, that we'll have old texts, like the Rosetta Stone,
yeah.
like to me is fascinating because we had no way of understanding Egyptian hieroglyphs and now we do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a stone that was found
yeah.
years after. So that's how like languages evolve. And one day we won't be able to read anything. I mean, like you know, scientists do say that one day in 5 billion years, this planet will be ash and,
yeah.
you know, nothing. And we'll be off on another planet if we survive at that point. But it's fascinating, isn't
yeah.
it? It's just like we don't actually know. So there is sort of like, I don't know, going into the existential crisis moment of like, you know, what's the point of everything? I think there is a lot of point. I think it's just
yeah.
fascinating to see the evolution of something go and be like, how do we, you know, keep some things alive, but also evolve
yeah.
into new words? And I mean, like, that's the joy of being, I guess, a writer,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Ooh, now, do you guys have a home dialect? Do you have things that is like just shorthand in your house from being partnered?
A few. I can't remember off the top of my head what they are.
Cass and I have descended into almost just like Muppet speak. It is so
we
dire.
Do, yeah.
Yeah. It's if a cat is doing something that's really cute, usually belly out, you know, like splayed on the floor, we started saying like, ew. Like, oh my God, you're so gross. Oh, you're so, you know, disgusting. And then that got shortened disgusting. And then, so now if I'm like, radio's being disgusting on the cat, he knows that he can go over and she's probably splayed out. And there's, can I have my Wawa bottle? It's just like toddler speak because it's just shorter and shorter and shorter.
Atrocious. I love it.
Brutal. It is so bad. It gets to the point back and forth. I mean, we could make noises just back and forth at each other forever. But between me shortening things, coming up with my own idioms and stuff like that, and then
we sort of like say when I love you, we say yeah, mom you.
Oh yeah.
Like we do things like that,
yeah.
or it's just like not even words.
Exactly.
It's just the noise.
Exactly.
Of when we need something, like we use the word need now, as in when we need to get out of a situation or we need each other's support, we just go need.
Need.
And that's yep. it. And it's like just little words where it's like, you know, we've just taken a word and we just go,
yeah.
we want that. That's it. And we don't need to communicate that to anyone
mm-hmm.
else. And there is a joy in that. It's like, you know, so bizarre.
And it's a microcosm of what happens to language on a wide scale, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you want to know what a word is going to sound like in 200 years, if you say it really fast over and over again, you'll hear where your palate is going to start to kind of skip steps. Mm. Because really the way that words change, unless it's for like a cultural reason or it's getting misconstrued as something, it's just our mouths being lazy. And especially the American palate is very, very, very lazy. I mean, you can even hear it in more like country and rural dialects where people are used to having chewing tobacco in the front of their teeth, and you can hear them talking around it. The New England accents in general are so much more like English and British still. We non-rhotic, we lose our R's at the end of our sentences and the end of our words. And our
words.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I've gotten to the point where I can say like, well, I have to go out to the car and get something. And that's slightly different than what I would say in South Carolina, which is I have to go to the car.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's just sitting in a totally different place in your mouth. Mm. And you can straight up, just if you're with somebody for long enough or in like the tech community, I'm sure has like a totally different, I know law is like that. Mm. Like there's words that are the same, that are pronounced the same, mean something different. There are words that are emphatically used differently. It's just, it's so cool. And it's one of the things that like, well, they say that it's linguistics is the only science that everybody thinks they're an expert on. Mm. Because when you're using a language, it feels very intimate to you. And it feels like when it's not being used the same way, it's being used wrong. But in reality, it's like watching like a tide pool, where if you see something that's not, you're like, oh, shit, that's weird. You're not going to pull it out and go like, okay, get out of here. Like, you're going to look at it and be like, this is interesting. This is fascinating. This fish I haven't seen before in this reef. Oh, my God, get it away from me. Like, no, you're going to be like, this is weird. What does this mean? What are the ramifications? Mm. And I just wish more people dealt with language that way, especially because so many people have like home languages that they've constructed with their siblings or their partners or something like that, just from shortening words, from like inside jokes. At one point, I heard a woman yell at her Rottweiler, and because it was chasing ducks on the beach, and she said, "You're not gonna get them, Linda." And so now every Rottweiler that I see is Linda to me specifically. So if I say, "Oh my God, it's a Linda," you know that that's what you're gonna be seeing. And oh, so my it's God. Stuff like that that it's just. It's not even necessarily quicker. Rottweiler, I guess maybe it's one syllable shorter, but it's just for being a personal thing, you know? And I drink a lot of seltzer water, but I just say seltzy.
Oh my God.
It's just my seltzy. That's all. Which is going to be probably the most controversial thing that I've said on here, because people either really like seltzer water or they absolutely hate seltzer water.
Wow, you've just really...
I really divided.
Yeah, you've really
divided. I completely divided the audience. Because some people, they're expecting sugar in it, but it's not. It's just water with a little kiss. Water, it's a little water that kisses you. Yeah.
It's so lovely. It's so nice. Delicate.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, but no, I will fight to the death about it. Yeah, seltzy. Our cats are ham sandwich and radio. Hammy's just hammy.
Yeah.
But radio, we'll just call radio.
Ham radio.
Radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even mean to do that originally. No, but we actually we got radio first, and then Hammy came.
But it's a ham radio.
Yeah,
that to me is the best.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm afraid we're running out of time. I could. I know. I could talk to you forever.
We're gonna go get lunch though.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, look, and we're gonna go and do photos, and it's gonna be great. But can I just say I've loved chatting to you.
This is
so much fun. I'm going to annoy
you all the way out here.
I know. Well, I'm going to come out again at some point, and then I'll annoy you again.
Please.
To come, because yeah, then we'll go and do a big adventure. when you're not going into surgery,
yeah,
it's like trying to aim it away from a surgery. But no, Sarah, where can people find you on the internet? Where can they stalk you?
So right now, before I implode it from the ground up, before I hit the demolition Instagram, I'm CoinSwallow there. And if you want to stare at Echo versus Slate, where Darker Further Down is listed, and you can see my little icon for it, and you can see my little description that is on, I believe, just echoverse.com. They're the production company that I'm working with. And other than that, you'll have to chase me down yourself. You'll have to find me. You'll have to sniff me out.
God, that sounds horrifying. It makes you sound like really ominous of just like, find me.
I'm fast too.
Yeah.
Dear God. Skitter around.
Yeah, you're like that crab walk, like, you know, yeah. Like, just like.
You'll see me and then I'm gone.
I'm just getting Toy Story in the back of my head, where it's like that scene where all the like disformed toys come out, and like I'm like, oh, you're like the one with the baby head doll and the spider legs.
I have way more appendages than it looks like.
Yeah, you hide it well.
It's the big sweater.
Yeah, I know. You know, like, I mean, they can see it because it's like being filmed, but also I love the idea. Because if no one sees this film version, they'll just imagine you as a giant spider creature, like, which is great.
Thank you. It's appropriate. Feminine horror. We got it. We looped back. It worked.
So good. I've loved chatting you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And if you want to go and check out more episodes of The Things We Do, you can check them out on Apple and Spotify. I'll be speaking with another guest next week, and I'll speak to you later. Goodbye!